Good evening, I'm Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida. Welcome to Tuesday Topics. Let me begin by thanking our producer, Brian Charlson, our recorders, Rachel Bader and Steve Bauer, our editor-in-chief, Steve Bauer, who turns this chaos into a good program, and also our participants this evening who will make this show as good as it will become, and obviously the person who is responsible for the software that we're using tonight, George Bies from Talking Communities. Tonight we're doing a topic that we had talked about doing a couple of weeks ago, and technical difficulties precluded us from doing that. I have known our guest now for, I guess, about the last 12 years, but we've known of each other for a lot longer than that, because both of us spent some time in the Caribbean. His name is Aubrey Webson, and I think perhaps what we ought to do to begin with is just ask Aubrey if he will tell us a little bit about who he is and where he came from and what he does now. Good evening, Aubrey.
Thank you very much, Paul, and good evening to you and to the participants on the show. Paul, I am Aubrey Webson, as you said, and I am from the Caribbean, from Antigua. I was born in Antigua, in a very small village. Antigua has a population of less than 90,000 people. And I was born in one of the seaport fishing villages called English Harbor, which had a population of just over 300 people. I grew up in Trinidad at the School for Blind Children in Santa Cruz, Trinidad. I grew up there because on Antigua in the 1960s, when I was growing up, there were no programs for blind children. So the children from the Eastern Caribbean, that is people living north of Puerto Rico, living from the Virgin Islands down to Trinidad or Guyana in South America, went to school in Trinidad, while kids or people who lived on the west and further north went to school in Jamaica. So I grew up in Trinidad, and then I, at the age of about 17, returned to Antigua, where I finished my education and went to University of the West Indies, following in your footsteps, Paul, you being the first blind person to attend UWI. I followed into your footsteps as the second person, and then I went on to university in the United States, and I am currently working for Hilton Perkins at the Perkins School for the Blind as their senior consultant responsible for services in Africa and the Caribbean.
Before we get to what you're doing now, I'd like to actually go back and talk about one of your earlier jobs anyway. I don't know what you actually did after coming out of the United States university system. I know that what ended up happening is you ended up getting the job that I got offered and actually turned down. And it's actually one of the coolest jobs in the whole wide world, especially if you're an advocate and especially if you care about people who are blind. And this job had to do with beginning to work on various islands in the Caribbean to help to organize blind people into organizations of blind folks, and at the same time create service delivery systems within local islands. Can you tell us a little bit about that job, what you thought about when you took it, and what the results were?
Yeah, that was a very exciting time in my life. I left UWI, University of the West Indies. I was 24, 25 years old, and I was offered the position of Chief Executive of the Caribbean Council for the Blind, the first Caribbean person to be offered the position. And there were a number of challenges. Bearing in mind at that time, I was also I came from a background where I was in the mood of change, and I needed, and I had been an activist in the whole blindness sector. I'd been an activist in general social sector within the Caribbean. And I took my activism from my youth leadership work, which I had done prior to going to university, into the work of the blind. And we used to say two things. We had to catch up to the world because we were so far behind. And then at the same time, we had to make sure that we didn't destroy anything, that we built on things. So we worked at all of the strands: education, rehabilitation services, and organization development. It was a big learning curve for me, and it was a big learning curve for the colleagues who worked with me, because we were doing something that was actually very new. We were trying to build a regional organization and to provide services throughout the region, and the Caribbean had done that in other areas, and not except for the University of the West Indies and the cricket team, a lot of that hadn't stuck. So we, a couple of the things we did were introduced rehabilitation training on a wide scale. And what we call rehabilitation is not just what you might call in the States home teaching. It's rehab in the broad sense, which includes orientation and mobility, includes job placement and job services and job training, and includes the traditional skills of daily living, etc. So we had to build that, train people in the region, because there were no training programs. So we designed O&M courses, we designed what we called the community-based rehab courses, and we then went about building those organizations of and for blind persons to be led by blind people so that they can begin to transform. We did something we called, created a youth leadership program back in the early 80s, which probably one of the things I think I am most proud about it, because out of that, we were able to get a lot of people to go to universities, blind folks. We were able to get the program, get people to lead the organizations. We were able to get blind people to have a voice. And through those programs, we then moved on into education. We couldn't put schools for the blind, so we started mainstreaming kids on a number of islands: Antigua, Grenada, St. Vincent, Belize in Central America, Guyana in South America, well before the crave of, or I guess during the crave of inclusion here, but before it became internationally fashionable. So those are some of the things, but it was an exciting time trying to work on all of those things at the same time.
I think one of the interesting things for me was the contrast, and maybe you can talk about that, because there actually were organizations for the blind in Jamaica. There was the Salvation Army. In Trinidad, there was the School for the Blind. There was also the Blind Welfare Association. And I guess my question to you is, to what degree do you think those entities were in fact barriers, and to what degree do you think that they were facilitators of rehabilitation for blind folk?
Well, I think we have to take those organizations in a sort of a twofold. They were in their time, I guess in the 60s and 50s, they were in their time very useful. They certainly, the Schools for the Blind in the 60s and 70s served a purpose. I mean, testimony to that would be people like myself who came through that system. So they were in their time. By the 80s, though, many of those organizations had lived their life, and they were not understanding change, and they did not know anything about new trend or thinking in services. And it was therefore very important to change the leadership and change the thinking. That happened very successfully in Jamaica. It did not happen as successfully in Trinidad.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. But I suppose from the perspective of an American who perceives organizations of the blind and organizations for the blind as really two separate strands, it must be hard to imagine a rehabilitation system where one of the issues is not upsetting the apple cart so that the philanthropy stops, because frankly, at least I would think this is true, and you can tell me if you agree, in most third world countries, and certainly in the Caribbean where you and I grew up, because I really feel like I grew up in the Caribbean, I was there from the time I was 13. In the Caribbean, the service delivery model had to include philanthropy, had to include buy-in from the upper classes and from private giving, or it simply wouldn't survive. And it must have, at least to a degree, made real organization and real heavy duty, let's say that instead, advocacy a little more difficult. Do you agree?
I'm not sure. Based on the culture, I think there were a couple of things happening. A lot of things are timing. Huh? At the time when the Caribbean Council became of age in the 80s, it was the United Nations decade of the disabled. They were just about. At that time, there were DPI was just coming alive, and they were speaking about disability. I also think it had to do with leadership, in a sense. I think I was fortunate as the leader because I had been involved in cross-sectorial services. I was not in the blindness system after I left school. I was working in social activism. And when we started to try to change systems, but yet keep things, I could call on people who went to university with me. I could call on guys who were in the youth movements with me. I could call on people who knew, leaders who were older than me, but knew me from my work. So by having that cross-section, we had a similar fortune in Jamaica, because one of the guys in particular was, again, outside of the system, and then came into the system and was able to call on things from outside. So I think in a way, one of the problems I think about blindness services, maybe in North America, and maybe you can tell me more, but one of the problems I found with the blindness system when I joined it in terms of change is that the blindness system was very closed around itself. But by being closed around itself or around certain kind of philanthropists, it did not allow itself to breathe. It did not allow itself to grow. It did not allow itself to truly develop advocates. And it was really speaking to the choir.
Actually, I absolutely agree with that. And I think that maybe when we get there later on, we can talk a little bit about the state of rehabilitation in the United States. But I think that in the 60s and 70s, at the very time when places like the Caribbean and even places like Europe in some respects, and Australia and New Zealand, were actually getting more blind people involved at the center of the rehabilitation process, the United States was actually doing the opposite and was creating a system that was very stultifying. And when I got back to this country, the thing that struck me the most was the degree to which there was such limited expectation of people who were blind who were in the rehabilitation process. It was okay for you to be incompetent, and it really didn't matter if you came back to the rehab center 6 or 7 or 8 times and didn't learn a darn thing any of the times that you were there. That was okay, because that was what the rehabilitation system was all about. I don't think we would have permitted such a thing in the Caribbean or anywhere else in the third world.
Absolutely. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. In fact, I'll tell you one of the things that I remember most vividly as a leader in the Caribbean Council at the time was attending a conference in Puerto Rico and literally saying to the teachers, because of the low expectation they had, I literally said, you guys should go home. Get out of here. If your expectation of blind people is that, you do not need to be in here. Because you are teaching and you're not believing what you're teaching. And we would not have accepted that in the Caribbean. And we certainly felt, at least certainly in the 80s at that time, that we needed to drive things in a different direction. And in relationship to your first question, that's where Trinidad's blind welfare would have been a stumbling block in the path. And that's where we had to put blind persons in leadership and organizations to change that.
And that's actually what's happened in so many other parts of the world, though not, I think, to the same degree in the United States. So, after the Caribbean Council, what happened to Aubrey Webson then?
After I left the Caribbean, I then came to the States to pursue my master's degree. I went to the New School of Social Research, where I did my master's and then some postgrad work in organizational development. And I wanted to return to the Caribbean. It's been that's where my life. That's what I love. So I did. Sightsavers International gave me an offer to, and I went back to the Caribbean for 2 years. And then Perkins had been trying to employ me for a number of years before that. While I was at school in New York, I also worked with Helen Keller International. And then I accepted the Perkins position in 1992. And there were some personal reasons around that. But I accepted the position, and I've been at Perkins since, working in the international program.
And maybe you could spend a few minutes telling us about what Hilton Perkins is, and then telling us a little about the international program and the role that you play in it.
The Hilton Perkins program is, first of all, it's a program within the Perkins School for the Blind. It's called the Hilton Perkins program because it's funded by the Hilton Foundation. The Hilton Foundation provided Perkins with a very sizable and useful grant back in the late 1980s, and the focus was to provide support for the development of services for deafblind, multi-handicapped blind children, including services in early intervention and advocacy for parents. That program has developed and took on to it also through a collaboration with Sightsavers International in the UK, work towards the development of organizations of the blind, in Africa particularly. My role is that I wear two hats. I am the program, the consultant in relationship to the development of organizations of blind people in Africa. And I am the consultant on child services, deafblind and multi-handicapped children services in Africa and the Caribbean. To that end, my work is to, from the children end, to help in the development of services, in the provision of support for training personnel in that area, in working with governments and the agencies in policy development, and to create all around a better environment for deafblind and multi-handicapped blind children and their families to participate in society. I spend a lot of my time also with the organizations of blind people, where we have helped organizations to become advocates on the one hand, but also to be involved in service delivery on the other, and to strengthen organizations and build their capacity to participate in civil society within the context of their country and culture.
Let's start with the kids first then, because this is an area of your work that I didn't know as much about. First, let me test a hypothesis. In the 1970s and 1980s in the United States, there was this huge spike of multiply handicapped births based in part on improved medical services. I assume there are some improvements in medical services in the third world, so I'm not suggesting that there aren't, but I'm suggesting that there probably aren't as stark and as immense as they've been here. So is the incidence of multiply handicapped blindness and deaf blindness actually lower per capita in third world countries than it is here?
At this time, yes, and there are different reasons, of course. Yes, but you also have to remember, because of the same fact that there isn't as good medical services, the kids who are born multi-handicapped, many of them don't survive. So it sort of balances out. But in per capita, yes, it's higher, because the whole question of disease and blindness, disease and accidents and so on are higher in those countries, and therefore the ratio of multi-handicapped children is higher. At the same time, the fact that advocacy is working, we are unearthing and finding families coming forward with their multi-handicapped and or deafblind children more so than they did 10 years ago.
And I would also probably suggest that in a lot of third world countries, the number of vanilla blind people is probably larger than it is here, which means that that would depress the proportion of deafblind folks as well. in this country, we perceive services to kids who are deafblind as extremely expensive, and we perceive services to multiply handicapped blind people as extremely expensive. And I suppose there are some who would argue that those services actually come with a pretty large price tag and relatively minimal results. How does that translate into the third world, where there presumably is a lot more competition for scarce resources, which means that it's harder and harder to find money that you can actually use to spend on serving populations whose long-term prognosis at least would seem to be pretty minimal?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the concept of their lifespan or their life or their or services them or their like their contribution to humanity as being minimal is we don't accept it. I don't. It's unacceptable. Every human being, regardless of how he or she is born, has his or her life is worth living. It's worth something. And working from that premise, it means that that child is a child, and therefore, irrespective of the cost, has to be given an opportunity. Has to be given a life, even if it is just a life of comfort, and in many cases it isn't, it's a life of development. It is more expensive in some ways, but as we work with government, and as governments take on international conventions and international mandates, and we respect, and as we move in today's humanity to respect each life, then the question of cost has to be put to the side. It is a constant debate, a constant discussion, a constant battle. In some countries, they have done very well. In some countries, the international INGO community and the whole international development community, INGO being international non-government organizations, have put a lot of resources. But the resources that is put in financial terms from outside is actually small in comparison to what the country itself puts. For an example, in most countries that I work in Africa, teachers in the schools that work with deafblind children, all the teachers in the school system in general, are paid by government. And if the government pays the teachers, that's a significant contribution. A lot of times government provide the buildings, the physical plant, and that's a significant contribution. Now, the techniques and the technology and equipment and so on, government has a lot more issues with that because they do not have the capacity to train people, and or the people who require training in that field are competing against scarcity of nurses, scarcity of doctors, etc., etc.
Tell us what your expectations are of deafblind and multiply handicapped folks in the third world. Let's assume you start working with a kid as a child and that child grows up. What is your expectation that the prognosis for that those kids are going to be? Do you actually go a little further than we typically do in this country towards trying to create employment opportunities for these populations?
First of all, my prognosis is based on humanity. I mean, the thing that I work for is to families to have respect and love for their child so that they can see that child as a member of their family and to absorb it in the family as such. If that is accomplished, a significant amount of whatever happens next is done simply by that child being accepted and loved and the family recognizing difference. In terms of expectation for the child's participation in the broader society, that of course depends on each child. There are deafblind children who will be able to grow up and participate in society. Not a lot, but there are. And there are those who will be average, and there are those who will be so severely disabled that they probably won't be able to participate as much in the broader society. But every child brings something to the family, and that's why the emphasis is on the family's participation, the family's acceptance. Because every child that is born into humanity brings something, joy, love. And if that child can receive that, he or she is giving back something to that family in that way. And that's something that I think when we get to a broader discussion that we need to address as well. So in general, my hope, my work, my dream is to get the family involved, get the families changed, get the society accepting, and then as the person develops according to his or her individual capacity, to get them into life. We are now at the Perkins program, getting to the point where the kids who started in the program 15 years ago are reaching the age where they're going to be leaving school and so on. And so we are seeing that we have to be part of that to some extent. And yes, we work in South Africa. I do some work and advise, consult with the National Deafblind Association, which we have been able to help them put together. In St. Lucia, we do some work with the National Multi-Handicap Committee that we've been able to put together. And these groupings, we are hoping, groupings like them, will move the thing forward in terms of services beyond children.
Let's go back to a basic premise and perhaps broaden the discussion a little. Given the scarce resources in the third world, whether we're talking about the Caribbean or Africa, given the widespread incidence of AIDS, for instance, in many countries, given the relatively poor economic prospects for many of the countries in continental Africa, isn't it accurate that disability remains pretty marginalized in terms of a priority within the country? And if that's the case, what do you do to change that?
We have seen some significant changes in the last 10 years in the role of disabled people in Africa and in the Caribbean. Let me just, I was just reading today from Floyd in Jamaica, who is a blind guy who is a junior minister of government, and he was speaking of the changes in the law that they want to bring about in Jamaica to make disabled people be more participative in their society. In many of the islands in the Caribbean, there is work being done towards changing law and changing, which then will help to bring about societal change. But more than that, in Africa, there are significant work being done in South Africa, in Uganda. In Uganda, for example, throughout the tiers of government, from local government, community level, to national parliament, there are mandatory places in government by constitution for disabled people to be part of the government. Now, you don't have that here. So that they can bring the voice of the disabled to the table. So from the governmental level, the legal structures in countries like Uganda, they are bringing about change. What that has done is that then puts disabled people not as beggars, but on the pavement, in the newspapers, on the radio, in the parliament. And there's nothing more to change society than to see people participating together. So that change is happening. It is slow, and you're still competing for scarce resources, but you have a chance. In South Africa, similarly, there are laws. They're members of the disabled people in parliament, not in the constitution, but by practice. Coming out of the revolution, the government of, so the ANC government gave disabled people spaces in their parliament. All of the political parties follow suit and have since done the same thing. So the disabled people representing voices, not just the voice of the disabled, but representing communities. And therefore, again, rubbing shoulders, there are job opportunities by law, and so on and so on. So some of that is happening. Of course, there's a lot of work to be done, but the cry is beginning to happen, and in the last 10 years, 10, 15 years since I've been in Africa, I can tell you, we have seen significant changes in most countries, where I have worked with anyway, And though this battle is on, there are all kinds of cultural and social issues that has to be put into the mix. I am just speaking in general about the legal structures that support change.
It's fascinating. If you read statistics that come out of places like the World Blind Union and the United Nations, you see that the literacy rate among blind people in continental Africa is 1% or not very much more than that. Admittedly, the statistics I've seen are probably 7 or 8 years old. So it may be a little bit better than that. And so on the face of it, one might say that it is startling that so many of the blind people and disabled people in general in third world countries are finding roles for themselves. And I know, talking with you in the past, that one of the factors that you think causes that is that because everybody is starting from such a far way down the economic pyramid, it's actually possible to put disabled people in positions of advantage by providing them with training. Could you talk a little about that?
Yeah, I think that is true. And first of all, yes, the statistics around persons who are in education, who are educated and so on, the statistics are high, and are low, sorry. And there are a lot of, just over 1%, it's probably a little higher than that now. But a couple of things have happened in that respect. Again, if you took Uganda, the country, they suggested changes by the government where the a blind person, if you have, for instance, the law for universal primary education in Uganda mandates that if you have children, that the first child who must be given free education is a girl, the second must be a disabled child. So then anybody else after that. Yes, I think the question of training and giving the blind person an advantage is true. We see it in some of the countries like South Africa, where there is good training available. The fact that you're starting from a position where many people are poor, you're starting from a position of certain types of cultural advantages in some of the societies, male advantage and some female. And therefore, wherever you start, from whatever point you start, and you are able to provide the training to the person, anybody who can earn an income, anybody who can bring in money, has an advantage in such a society. And therefore, if the blind person has training and his or her economic power is stronger than anybody else around, he or she has a strong advantage and can participate in the family because of that ability to earn.
And your rehabilitation, I think, or the approach that you take to rehabilitation is substantially different from the approach that we take here. And I think it would be accurate to say that at least one of the core values of your rehabilitation is that the community within which the blind person must operate is an inherent and absolute necessity to involve, and that individual is in effect made capable of more fully participating in his or her community as a core value of the rehabilitation. Would you agree with that?
Yes. I think we believe very strongly that community participation is significant to the rehabilitation process. That taking people away from their community for significant periods of time and provide them with training does not allow them with the same level of confidence to get back into society, into their communities, and therefore to participate. I think that if we did a real study in the United States, and maybe in Europe, but certainly in the United States, and looked at people's, once they've had their rehab training, how many people then find work as a direct result of that training, I think we could be very shocked by the numbers. And if you took people who were able to fight their way through their community, receive some level of services, but within their community, and look at those persons who found jobs and the kind of jobs they found, I think you will find that the people who found the stronger jobs equal to their capacity and intelligence and their whatever their level of training is. You'll find those who have had less support from some of the systems to be the persons who have found the better jobs. Let me also at the same time say one of the core thing to rehab for us is building the empowerment of the individual. Self-actualization. You cannot train people to create change in their lives without training them to be confident about who they are, why they are, what they are. And what we call empowerment or self-actualization is critical to getting to any rehabilitation process. What I call social negotiations is critical to building confidence for participation in communities.
Do you think there is or are some generalizations that in fact operate?
No, I think there are some generalizations. I think there are some cultural differences depending on the ethnic groups, especially within Africa. But there are some generalizations as well, because some of the sociology around the reaction or perception of blindness that has been developed in some societies in the Caribbean is an example. Some of it is based on Western teaching, Western models of Western relationship to people relationship. And some of those are absorbed into African and Caribbean culture. And yet, those cultures have their own perceptions that may be different. So there are some general things and there are some things that are similar.
Talk us through, you can choose which one, but talk us through one project that you're actually working on right now, one specific project, how it started, what you're hoping to accomplish, and what you've managed so far.
I'm going to tell you about two things. I know you said one. Okay?
Go for it. Two things will work fine.
All right, let me tell you about something that we're doing called the Africa Forum. The Africa Forum is a concept that was developed primarily to get blind persons in Africa leaders, get the government agencies that work in the field of blindness, the NGOs, international government organizations, and so on, get a network speaking together. Firstly, the idea was to create in Africa an opportunity for Africans to speak to the agenda of blindness, so that it is not spoken to from Europe and North America, which it has been for eons. Secondly, it is to get Africa to recognize what is happening across Africa, to get professionals and the leaders in the blindness field to begin to share, and then to take the material from that to begin to build a resource base so that people can go back and say, this is what is happening in Ghana. This is what is happening in Gambia. This is the type of community-based rehab. This is the kind of empowerment structures, and so on. So the Africa Forum was an agenda that we started back in 1996. And the fourth such event is going to take place in Kenya next year. And it's growing by leaps and bounds, where people from across the continent are coming to be part of this thing, so that they can begin to be part of the African voice, the African agenda. And that's something that I was very, very keen in doing that. That's something in a slightly different way I had begun in the Caribbean in the mid-80s, and I am very pleased to have that has been moved into the African realm and been absorbed. One of the more intriguing things I'm working on right now is issues around inclusion for blind children in South Africa, where the South African government's policy of inclusion is very broad. It builds on the international, all of the international agendas taken in, a lot of what you do in the United States, and so on and so on. And I've just gotten back about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, from working on building a couple of things. One is helping the South African blindness sector to recognize, listen, there are some laws, there are things, government has made certain things. You can't bulldoze government. You got to work with it and take a position. And the position is, okay, so this is law, but we are going to help you to make this law work for all. And help them to build the advocacy skills to do that. And at the same time, help them to design what we are calling minimum acceptable standards. This is what is the minimum acceptable standard that a blind child should have for an education, regardless if it is in a school for the blind or it is in a mainstream program or inclusive program. And we are working on that, and hopefully we could have those standards and have that conversation continue with the government of South Africa so that blind kids do not get shortchanged. As I said to them in our work, none of us are against inclusion. We can't be. We are advocates for inclusion. We can't be against inclusion. But we certainly want the best. We certainly don't want children to receive an inferior education based on an ideology or philosophy.
Let's talk about one more thing, and then I think we're going to open it up. You probably have as good an idea as most of us do on the current status of the United Nations Convention on Disabilities. Could you tell us a little bit about where that came from? Maybe talk a little about why it took so long to happen, and also talk with us about some of the opposition that's still out there to it.
Where it came from, first of all, it was pushed by governments. Mexico government had a lot to do with it, Canadians, and some Central American and Latin American countries. Before the convention, we had the standard rules. The standard rules were guiding principles, if you might. And although many countries accepted the standard rules, and we had a rapporteur, there were no penalty. There was really no, you didn't have to do it. The convention addresses that. The convention, once you have signed it, is like signing the Convention on the Rights of the Child or the Human Rights Convention. Once you have signed it, there certainly can be pressure brought on by the General Council of the UN for you to respond to that. And that's the teeth of the convention over the standard rules. And that's the good thing about the convention. Of course, the opposition to it, like all of these United Nations conventions. First of all, why it took so long, obviously it took the length of time it took because what you're talking about is developing a set of rules or a charter that people have to live by. And there are cultural issues, there are issues from within the sector itself, the disability sector, and the disability sector defined in the convention is broad, very broad. And there are always going to be issues around that from within the traditional disability sector. And they're going to be, so it's a question of getting not only governments to meet minds, but also the non-government organizations and disabled people themselves who are not necessarily involved in organizations to meet minds. So that had to take the kind of time it took. Now we've got it. We have something, I think, to be proud of, and something that we can work with. As I say, I'm not an expert on the convention, so I'm not going to get into the details and nitty-gritty. I'll leave that to the expert.
One of the fascinating things to me is that, and I haven't really looked in the last 3 or 4 months, but until 3 or 4 months ago, one of the chief opponents of the convention was the United States, which fascinated me, and their reasons do too. Let's open it up for people to ask Aubrey some questions.
Aubrey, this is Mike Calvo from Freedom Box. I find some of your, I especially find what you're doing very intriguing, and have some questions, of course, pertain to my field, which is adaptive technology and its impact on blind folks in underdeveloped countries. I know that we've done some work in the Philippines and just how you see the internet and distance learning and training of individuals where perhaps transportation out to where they are by qualified trainers and whatnot be a challenge, and also perhaps getting them into the job by working remotely with folks that do understand the abilities, keeping in mind, of course, that all the social issues that you were explaining.
The first part of answer to the question is yes, access technology is making a difference, but it's hugely expensive, very expensive. It is making a difference because you can see it in the cities where people have had opportunities to be trained. One of the things that came out of the 1999 Africa Forum was technology, and we were able to put up a number of technology centers in Uganda and Ghana and so on and so on, and had people trained, and you see the difference. However, the numbers are relatively small, even in relationship to the numbers of people who have been educated. In recent times, the universities in a number of African countries are having access technology placed in the university, and therefore are creating more opportunities for learning. The thing that has probably taken off with the most fervor is cell phones. And the more cell phone technology becomes accessible, the more cell phone technology becomes your one-stop shop and becomes usable in ways other than just as a telephone, I think the more blind people and disabled people in general would become part of that age and would use it for business or commerce, use it for social relations, and use it as a tool that can help them earn. We see significant changes in people's lives once they have had the exposure to access technology, to all the different things that we have with computers and all the different things that are available, but the cost.
Hello, Aubrey. This is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. It seems like technology, the way it seems to be going, is going to really increase opportunities for all blind people throughout the world, I think, eventually.
I couldn't agree more. Technology, I think, is the big equalizer. I think a properly trained blind person who has access, and we in the States where we can get our agencies or governments or whoever to provide equipment, I think it's the equalizer. I think a blind person can be as competent as their sighted colleague with the influx of technology if they have the things that are available to them and if they can have the kind of training that they need. There is no greater, for me personally, there is no greater invention in my time than technology. What that has done, and I say this because in the 1980s when I went to university in the Caribbean, I worked with a brailler and a typewriter and the first breed of talking calculators, which I bought for $400. Today, I think I'm as competent as my colleagues in my office because I have the kind of things available to me.
Aubrey Sanisi from Atlanta. I wonder if you could go back and talk a little bit about what I think sometimes could be perceived as a dichotomy, in that in the developing world, you more so than the United States, you have organizations that are both consumer advocacy organizations and they're also providing services. And I wonder if that creates any kind of problem at all at times by having them providing services. Does that get in the way or have the potential of getting in the way of their effectiveness in advocacy work?
I think you have to see it in terms of the social structure of the society into which this is happening. In this country, the consumer groups or groups of blind people or groups of whatever the sector is, they see themselves as an advocate voice and they see a clear line between them and service. I am not so sure if that has to happen.
Aubrey, this is Brian Charlson from Watertown. One of the issues that have been talked about quite a bit in recent years has been something called microfinancing, where individuals pool their resources here in the developed if you will, the financially developed anyway, part of the world, and make microloans to individuals and small groups in the developing world to allow them to become financially independent through owning their own business, agribusiness, or whatever. Is there anything like that going on in support of persons with disabilities throughout the developing world?
There are lots of issues around it, though. In many countries, especially in the 80s and 90s, microfinance or microproject funding was the buzz. A lot of people did it. Everybody did it in the organizations of the blind. A lot of them did it, and a lot of them are still doing it. There are different kinds of those types of projects, and some work better than the others. In fact, just last week, I became part of a group, an e-group on microfinancing. I'm not sure if I did the right thing. I got so much mail on it every day. But the reality is that it is a major part of development, and the disability sector is part of it. What we have encouraged in the more recent times, in the last 5-10 years, in the disability sector, is that they do not create a microfinance structure that is blindness specific, for all the reasons around running a microfinance program. I mean, if you're talking about loans, and so you have to have all the skills of small banking, right? And what we are still suggesting to people is that they get involved with national microfinance projects, and that they work out certain kinds of system that the blindness sector can support them, because you still need to have securities and so on and so on. And a lot of the people may not have that. But the blindness broader sector can come together and provide the security for certain things. So the short answer, Brian, is yes, the sector is involved, but people are finding themselves into the larger system rather than just creating a blindness microfinance community.
Has the third world become the dumping ground for our old technology, or when we get involved in recycling of technology with the idea of it benefiting somebody else rather than ending up in a landfill in the U.S., does that really work?
You know, a lot of that is beginning to happen. Whether it works, a lot of people I have heard complain about it. It is going especially computers, the hardware. Very often you get an old computer, but you do not get the access technology, and very often the access piece can, because you have advanced in the States, or we have advanced, the piece that is available to work with the old computers create a lot of problems. It either can't work with it because the computers are too old.
Let me ask you one more technology question, just because it's an interesting model. Do you know whether Macintosh computers are making any inroads in the third world? And I ask the question for a particular reason. With the release of Tiger on April 29th of 2005, which is the Mac's operating system, its latest operating system, they actually have a built-in screen reader and screen magnifier, which ships with every single Mac computer, which means that in the third world, as long as people could afford the tariff for the Mac computer, the access technology is already there. It's not wonderful, but it sure works.
The only place I've heard of it making a major inroad and a big contribution to schools for the blind, and the whole education system in general, is in Malawi. They received the last year several thousand of those pieces through the education system, and they're the ones who told me about the access piece, the Tiger, and it's not great, but it's usable. And but that's the only country that I know where there was a real effort to get that happening.
So, Nito again, Aubrey, when is the African Forum, and where is it going to be? And then a question to Paul or Brian, who at ACB Radio should we write to participate in the forum?
This is Aubrey. The forum is the week of May 7th, next year, 07, and it is going to be in Nairobi, Kenya.
And I suppose that one would probably run this through the
board of directors of the American Council of the Blind, and that would percolate down to ACB Radio somehow. And since I'm a member of the ACB board, I can certainly raise that question. Aubrey, can you give us some final thoughts about what you'd like folks to take away from tonight?
Thank you, Paul. First of all, let me say thank you to you and Brian for the opportunity to share some of the work that we're doing through Perkins and through the work of the Hilton Perkins program, and also to share some of my own thoughts on services in Africa, the Caribbean, and the looking at what's going on here in the States. I think two things are very important for me I would want to leave. One is, I still think we need to sit together and rethink what I call rehabilitation services, which is inclusive of O&M. How we do it, who does it, what is the expectation behind it. I think our system, which includes those who train these people who are rehab or mobility workers, itself needs to sit and think through it. I think you cannot have rehab without empowerment. You've got to have empowerment as a concept in training and as a concept in delivery. I also think that the question of technology and how we in the United States can help change the paradigm in terms of what is available for technology to disabled people, blind people in particular, in developing countries, is a matter of which we wish we should sit again and discuss. And Paul, I want to urge you to take the discussion of ACB Radio participating at the Africa Forum to the ACB board. And thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you, Aubrey, and thank you to everyone else who participated this evening in our program. Thank you to those of you who listen. I think what's come out of this is that the differences between blind people in the third world and our country are not as large as we might sometimes think. And it may well be that blind people in third world countries, by having more expected of them, and by having more opportunity for upward mobility within a society that's more fluid, may in fact have more opportunities for upward mobility and advancement than we do in this country. And our rehabilitation system may have a lot to learn from what's being done in the third world, and we may have an awful lot to learn about what true rehabilitation is, because clearly in this country, empowerment isn't a core value in the generic rehabilitation system. And in the NFB's centers, many of us would argue that empowerment isn't either. Instead, it is the adoption of a set of propagandistic values that in fact don't lead to independence, but dependency on a specific philosophy. Aubrey, thank you very much again for being with us tonight on Tuesday Topics. Next week on Tuesday Topics, we'll have the opportunity to explore the personnel shortage. That is, the shortage of people who are available to provide quality services to people who are blind and visually impaired, whether it be in orientation or mobility, in rehabilitation teaching or whatever it's called now, or in rehabilitation counseling. Why is there such a shortage of folks to serve adults as well as a shortage of qualified vision teachers? What can we do about it, and what do we want to do about it? Join us next week when we'll explore with Diane Wormsley this exciting subject on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.